Welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you, and the phone lines are open, 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, that's the number to use, or from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, call us at 877-941-3689. What's it like to be mentally ill, or perhaps be mentally ill and not even know it? And what's it like to watch a member of your family struggle and know something is wrong, and also know they probably won't consider the possibility of mental illness? You might not stop to think about any of these questions, but tonight's panel focuses on them and others every day. It's why they say that Mental Health Month aside, Hawaii, as with most states, has a long way to go to care for its mentally ill residents. Tonight, we're going to take a look at what it's like to be mentally ill in Hawaii and get a snapshot of those who are mentally ill in Hawaii. And if you'd like to join us, again, our phone lines are open, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Joining me tonight, Jerry Coffey, Clinical Director of the Institute for Human Services and a board member of NAMI Hawaii; Maria Grams, the Executive Director of Mental Health America of Hawaii; and Dr. Dan Ulrich, Medical Director of the State's Department of Health, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Division. Thank you all for being here.
You're welcome. Hi, Bethany.
Thank you. Good to have you here. Some of you back now for many a time. Maria, we talked earlier in the week just to begin to approach this a little bit, as it's now May and there's a lot of focus on mental health. Clearly, though, mental health issues for all of you and for families who deal with this is an everyday activity. Let's talk a little bit about what it's like to be mentally ill in Hawaii and paint a couple of pictures of what it is. It's not necessarily the folks who wind up only in the headlines that we see that may pull some attention toward it, but that's more the exception than what you see every day as the rule. Maria?
Yeah, people are getting the impression that some people with severe mental illness are violent because it's been making the headlines, but that's really not true. 96% of the violence that's committed in this country is committed by people who are not mentally ill, which means if we cured everyone with mental illness, we'd wake up the next day and we'd have 96% of the violence intact. And in fact, when you look at the mass murders, 80% of them were committed by people who did not have a mental illness.
Who are quite sane indeed.
Yes.
So in looking at what we've seen happen over the last couple of months, last several years, things that have certainly made the headlines and made people sit back and think more, perhaps a little bit more anyway, about mental illness, have you been charting any of this in terms of whether there's been more of that 4% that we're seeing now than we did in years past?
Well, I think there's been more guns. And I think the more guns there are, the more violence there is. So I think that's part of the reason. But I think the other part of the reason is that we do not have an adequate mental health system in this country. We do not have a safety net. You know, they emptied out the state mental hospitals 50 years ago, but there's never been anything in its place except jail and the streets. And so really, people with mental illness, with severe mental illness, are treated as inhumanely now as they were 50 years ago when they were locked away. So there are more and more people who are not getting the treatment they need and are spiraling into deeper and deeper mental illness.
At the same time as they're going in and out that revolving door of jail, back on the street, jail. Jerry, you see a lot of this in some form or other. Any explanation on your part as to why perhaps this seems to be captivating us a little bit more now than it has in past?
There's a huge intersection between homelessness and mental illness. And certainly if we're driving through the streets of Honolulu, we're seeing a lot of homeless folks, unfortunately. The number of homeless folks since the year 2009 until present has continued to climb. For the island of Oahu, we have just about 5,000 was the number that was most recently issued from the 2013 point in time count. I think that number is probably much lower than what is really going out there. But to the extent that a relapse to mental illness results in homelessness or a relapse to an addiction, if street drugs or alcohol is our form of medication for a mental illness, If there's a correlation between mental illness and homelessness, which I believe there is, and I see it every day, it's definitely there. And the level of vulnerability, I think also that we're seeing come into the emergency shelters at IHS in particular, folks are older, folks have more medical comorbidity, and certainly there's the trimorbid mental illness. That would be everything from a mood disorder, which would probably be true for the majority of the folks living in the shelter, all the way up to, you know, very, very profound unmedicated psychotic disorders. And, of course, post-traumatic stress disorder, which is something that most homeless people do have in common. PTSD would be the common cultural, if there is a culture of PTSD, certainly that would be the one thing that most homeless folks do have in common. They're a very disparate group of people. People can become mentally ill and land in a homeless shelter who come from a lot of money and have lots of education and had a full and productive life. And then, of course, we see folks coming into the shelter who are coming from years and years of intergenerational mental illness, intergenerational domestic violence, intergenerational poverty.
And we can't forget that Senator Chun Oakland recently discovered that 44% of homeless people, including in shelters and out of shelters, are employed.
That's true. 80% of the folks who live in our family shelter, we have a single women, single men, and family shelter. 80% of those folks are working. However, they're not earning a living wage. So we're able to keep them with us. Average length of stay for families is 4 to 8 months. Help them save money. Similarly, for our single men and single women, much harder if they're unmedicated and have been diagnosed with a severe and persistent mental illness, for sure.
Dr. Erlich, you see a little bit different population because you're dealing with children, adolescents. Put that into this picture too, because this is more of the adult picture that we've gotten up to this point. But when we're talking about kids, particularly in those turbulent years of adolescence, when for a lot of people the question is, well, is this adolescence at the extreme, or is this really something more?
Mm-hmm. No, great question, Beth Ann. And, you know, clearly what we do know is that many mental health conditions really start or can be identified in childhood, even earlier, and certainly many of them, you know, are exposed and sort of bloom or cause the most difficulties during adolescence. And you're exactly right, sort of making that determination. Is this just, you know, a youth, is my son or daughter just kind of sowing their oats and doing sort of normal boundary testing and limit testing and, you know, rebelling against authority, or is it really a problem, a disorder? And one, and Jerry, I know you were kind of mentioning this, you know, I think looking at how often it's occurring, frequency, how troubling it is for that particular youth. What's the intensity? And is it really keeping them from really performing those things or doing those things that are pretty typical? Is there a big change in their school performance or their interactions with friends or school activities? Those would be more signs to indicate that, yeah, this is more than just adolescent growing pains or, you know, experimentation, that indeed there may be more of a issue going on that at least bears more, you know, assessment and a better understanding.
If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about mental illness in Hawaii. What does it look like? Who does it affect? Maybe it affects you or your family. If you'd like to join the discussion, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Jerry, when all of you, and all of you too, as we look at kids, you know, and we look at them on one end, we say, well, they're kids. On the other side, their behavior can be dangerous to themselves or to other people. How do you start to look at this with some sort of metric to see whether what Dr. Ulrich is saying, you know, their changes in their behavior begins to set off more alarm bells than, oh, gee, maybe this is just adolescent anger or angst or just, you know, trying to figure out who they are and trying to pull away from authority, all those things that have been traditionally wrapped up in adolescence.
One of the most important things we're able to do at IHS, and it feels like we have a bunch of kids at a homeless shelter, because we're really working with folks who somewhere along the road in their development, there was a barrier. And so another way to frame the discussion or the conversation about, shucks, when should I be worried? is to think about the different developmental milestones that we know we're supposed to be hitting throughout our life, not just as children and adolescents and young adults, all the way up through the years. So we have an opportunity at IHS through the programs and the case management to stop people in their tracks and help them to see. Sometimes we do it gently, and sometimes we develop contracts with folks in order to get their attention. But really what we're saying is, hey, check it out. This is an important thing that you need to be doing at this time in your life to be successful and happy, not to load any particular paradigm about what being successful and happy looks like. I would just say functional. Certainly at IHS, we're starting there. You're not having success in these areas. No judgment, no blame. What do we need to do differently? For a lot of folks, whether they're adolescents or adults, asking the question, you continue to engage in this behavior or you continue to have these same consequences and you keep doing it. What need of yours is getting met by continuing to engage in the same dysfunctional behavior over and over again?
And an adolescent will buy into that kind of
conversation
too? An adolescent
can.
Marja?
Well, I want to talk a little bit about my own experience because I looked pretty normal. I got great grades as a kid. I had a lot of friends. Everybody considered me very outgoing, and I was presumably doing fine. When I left for college, I had a complete breakdown and became suicidal, and I spent a year in a psychiatric hospital. What people didn't know is that I had been growing up in a home where my father beat my mother, he was a severe alcoholic, and he was attempting suicide periodically. So I was traumatized over and over and over again, but nobody talked about it. So I was one of those invisible children. Nobody got me help. But there were no signs from anybody else that I was in trouble until, college. That's the year that I snapped.
Until you couldn't carry the weight of all that anymore.
No.
Dr. Ulrich, I saw you nodding as Marja was telling her story because trauma can be a big factor.
Absolutely, and your story, Marja, is not uncommon. And we, in fact, often see those breaks or those signs much, much earlier. And Bethann, you are correct. The more and more cases we see, and in fact, the majority of the cases, we see of mental illness in children and adolescents often have a common denominator of exposure to trauma and adverse events in childhood. And interesting thing, we're actually getting to a point where clinical research and studies are actually showing and demonstrating the links to why these things are occurring. But there are real changes in brain and brain neurochemistry based on exposure to trauma and the different triggers within the brain and the neurochemicals and hormones that then set the stage either genetically for unveiling maybe a mental illness that is there and
if
causing that.
If one would be
break,
predisposed for that.
Correct. Or certainly making it worse. The other interesting link is that exposure to these traumas and early adverse events really impact physical health. And there's a really, really powerful study called the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Event Study, which links many of these events early in childhood, these negative experiences, to physical health problems, increased rates of cancers and diabetes, and abnormal cholesterol, heart disease, etc., all that can be tied back and correlated to early childhood trauma and adverse exposures.
Jerry.
One of the common denominators for folks that we see who are mentally ill and homeless, aside from trauma, at the shelter, is a across-the-board, almost complete lack or absence of family members who would be what we consider a protective factor. So in the world of mental health, we know there's protective factors, things that will mitigate and ward off severity or duration or level of impact with a mental illness. And protected factors, for most of us, if we're lucky, are family members. Most folks who land in a homeless shelter have burned out and completely alienated themselves from the people who are probably the most important people to have a positive impact and be a positive influence to the extent that families can do that. A good outcome, hopefully, for your show tonight, Bethann, is that folks will understand that burning out as a family member is not uncommon, but there are many, many things and certainly resources out there to support folks through that lifelong journey of supporting their loved one through their mental illness. Relapse is part of recovery. That's a term that the folks in addictions have used for years, which basically means, you know, if you have an addiction, you're probably going to fall off the horse. You're probably going to fall off the wagon. And every time you do that, hopefully you'll get more sophisticated and more knowledgeable and more develop more understanding about what were the risk factors that got you there. And the period of time between those relapses will become longer and longer. And I wanted to chat just briefly about the incredible and powerful support. And one of the resources is NAMI. You mentioned earlier, I am a member of the board of directors for NAMI Hawaii. NAMI is a support system for family members who are dealing with a loved one who's been diagnosed with a mental illness. And we have several different core programs. And the most important core program that NAMI offers for any family member who's struggling with a child, young adult, or grown adult with a mental illness is our family-to-family support group, which is co-facilitated by graduates of the family-to-family curriculum. And it becomes it's a closed group, so it's confidential. There are not new folks cycling in each time. And it's an opportunity for family members to really sit and hear from each other in a formal setting. The format is a curriculum that has been developed and approved by NAMI. And also just informal sharing and resource sharing between people who have been there, done that, and seen it. It's a really powerful opportunity for people who sometimes for the first time in their entire life have been able to sit in a room with others and really just hear and
figure out they're not alone.
Speak honestly about it, correct?
Our number is 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Tonight we're talking about mental illness in Hawaii, in adolescents, in adults, maybe in your own family. We want to hear from you. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Woody calling us from Honoka'a. Aloha, Woody. Welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. I just had a question about, I have a really good friend who is diagnosed with bipolarism in her early 20s. Now she is about 40, but she hasn't taken, she doesn't take medication or anything, and I'm just wondering, is once you're diagnosed, is bipolarism something that ever goes away? And then my other question is, what is the cause of bipolarism?
Dr. Earlwork, I think that's one for you.
Wow. Good questions, Woody. Indeed, if your friend meets the full criteria for bipolar disorder, it really is a severe mental illness and typically will be lifelong or chronic. There are many cases, though, where people will get quote-unquote labeled or told they have a particular condition. And like many illnesses or medical conditions, sometimes the symptoms that one is exhibiting at a point in time may be more severe and intense, and often that can maybe be because of the circumstances or stressors going on in one's life that can maybe make that seem more pervasive, more severe. Oftentimes, I think we all see that even in children and adolescents, substance abuse can sort of be a co-occurring condition, often linked with mental illness. So I would say, much like Myra, there's no reason why mentally ill people are more predisposed or inclined to substance abuse or substance dependence disorders. But sometimes that can be a sort of a confounding factor. But really, bipolar is a brain. It is a biologic disorder where there really is a dysregulation of those key neurochemicals in the brain that help modulate mood. And what happens with bipolar is one goes to the extremes of the mood spectrum. They tend to have episodes of intense major depression where they're very down, often suicidal. And then they can have periods where they have the exact opposite, which is termed mania, which can be an elevated, euphoric, irritable mood, often with racing thoughts and high energy levels and, lack of need for sleep.
But I think treatment does work.
Absolutely, treatment does. And often medication would be considered a cornerstone and a necessary component of treatment for bipolar. But like many things, whether it be high blood pressure, diabetes, if one can get into a healthy situation where you know it's an episodic mood disorder, one may or may not need to necessarily be on medication throughout life. I would say most people with an authentic diagnosis of bipolar probably need some sort of medication management.
But there are people who do take their medication and become – and their bipolar disorder, the symptoms are eliminated – and they live rich and full lives for their entire life. So it's not,
absolutely.
It's no way a hopeless condition.
Absolutely. In fact, there are many, many examples of individuals who are quite accomplished in prominent leadership positions, world famous artists, musicians who have, not only survived, but have thrived and really done outstanding things with a diagnosis of bipolar.
We've got lots of callers on the line. Jerry, did you want to add something?
I just wanted to check back with Woody. And it's great that you called. You obviously are a friend and you love this person. It's not uncommon when we approach that conversation with loved ones and medication obviously becomes a part of the dialogue or the discourse. People resist that. So there are other things that we know that we can try first. In general, exercise, social interaction, diet, and hobbies, being involved in things that are
relationships,
yeah. Sure. As a friend, and if you encounter resistance to the idea that they would take medicine, be present and support that person that you love to exhaust those other alternatives so that you can get to the point where you say, okay, check it out. We tried these things. We've looked at your diet. We're running twice a week. I got you out. We're exercising. We're doing all these other things that we know that keep you busy and engaged and involved. Maybe you should consider the meds at this point. Maybe just a little bit of medication in combination with these other things that we know that help you could make the difference.
But a friend really has to be willing to walk that path with you. And
100%.
Not just say it. It's not a conversation. You're talking about really walking it.
And that's hard. It's hard for people, but that is certainly important for the person who's ill.
All right. We're going to go on now. And thanks very much, Woody, for the call. Going to John from Mo'ile'ile. Aloha, John. Welcome to Town Square.
Oh, yeah. You all said that. Hold on, let me turn my radio off. I get confused.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
55% who commit the crimes are not mentally ill, and there's 3% who don't commit the crimes who are. Is that what you said?
What I said is that of all the violence in this country, 96% of it is committed by people who do not have a mental illness, which means only 4% of it is committed by people who do have a mental illness, so that if we cured everybody with mental illness, we'd still wake up with 96% of the violence occurring. And then also that 80% of all mass murders are committed by people who do not have a mental illness.
Well, 90% of the people who commit a crime, they do have a mental illness. That's because they're committing a crime. They are mentally ill.
No, not necessarily. We're talking about a mental illness such as schizophrenia, such as bipolar disorder, such as major depression, post-traumatic stress syndrome, schizoaffective disorder. These people do commit, only 4% of these people commit crimes. All the rest of the crimes and violence are committed by people who are sane.
And Mari, these statistics come from where?
They come from numerous studies, government studies, private studies.
I think the distinction that you're making, Mari, is that some diagnoses involve a form of a mental illness where an individual doesn't have judgment. They don't have the ability or the capacity for judgment and critical thinking. What I think what's clear about the studies is that they show that people who do make that decision and that choice to be violent are found to be capable of critical thinking and are capable of judgment. Is
yeah,
that right?
I think some of us say, well, anybody who would do that must be crazy because that is such a terrible thing.
Which would you rather, if you had to care for somebody and bring them into your house, which group would you bring in? The 4% who are mentally ill but who don't do anything, or there's 96% who are not mentally ill but commit crimes? Which one would you rather live with?
I think that's really not a question that to stop and consider, at least for the discussion for tonight, because you're talking about a whole population, that all that 100%, which have committed crimes. It's just the reason that has led them to commit crimes. Mari's only point was 4% of them have mental illnesses that don't allow them to have the judgment to make a call whether they should or shouldn't do it. The other 96% have that capacity for judgment and choose to do it. And so although we may see lots of things in the news that say that someone is mentally ill and possibly that's the reason that they did whatever they did that was illegal, that was criminal, that's not necessarily a pervasive condition that, you can say, you can walk into a prison and say, oh, everybody here is mentally ill. That's really what she's trying to make a distinguishing point about. Thanks very much for the call, John. Going now to Beverly calling us from Kailua. Aloha, Beverly. Thanks
Aloha.
For your patience.
I'm calling to find out if there are any statistics about the percentage of the population of homeless on Oahu who are mentally ill. What percentage of the homeless are mentally ill?
Hi, Beverly. This is Jerry.
Hi, Jerry. I think you know who I am.
I don't know if I do or not.
Yeah. We just talked. We had an email this week.
Hey, you know, I can talk to what we see at IHS. IHS is the largest emergency shelter in the state. We sleep about 350 folks each night in our shelter. And about 80% of the folks who come through IHS, I believe, are active and current with some sort of a mental health issue or a diagnosis. We aren't able to get all the folks who come to our shelter to see our psychiatrist. We aren't able to learn about and understand the mental health histories of all the people who come into the shelter. But easily 80% of the folks that we know are walking around IHS and coming into IHS, some of them very functional too, by the way, are with a diagnosis, maybe not a psychotic disorder, but certainly major depressive disorder, PTSD. There's an interesting differentiation as we look at the different types of homeless populations on Oahu. The outreach team that I have that works in urban Honolulu, we have just about 500 what we call unduplicated, unsheltered homeless people that we outreach between Keomoku Street and the airport. What we know about the folks that we see camped on the sidewalks, for example, is that those folks, by and large, typically don't have a psychotic disorder or a major mood disorder. But are simply substance abuse is really what's driving their unfortunate circumstances. The folks who do have mental illness are typically more isolative. They tend to stick to themselves. Certainly that's not true in all cases. But I think the best answer I can give you is that the majority of the folks who have survived what it means to be homeless and have landed in a homeless shelter suffer from some form of a mental health issue, at the very least depression, and certainly PTSD.
Beverly, thanks very much for the call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the phone lines are open, 941-3689. If you're on Oahu, call that number. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream, you can get to us at 877-941-3689. You talk about the population that you see that comes into IHS, Jerry, and Dr. Ehrlich, you talk about the kids that you see, but getting to the point where either one of you can see anybody usually takes some sort of traumatic event, particularly if you're talking about a kid, because there really isn't a place to take a kid who may be mentally ill. What are you going to do until something horrible happens?
Oh, correct. I mean, it can be difficult. One thing that often there are early signs or indicators and a key
aspect.
Okay,
give me
aspect.
A shopping list.
Well, being more depressed, more withdrawn, talking about wanting to hurt yourself, not wanting to live, being too anxious or upset to go out or participate in typical things, not sleeping well, not eating well, not seeming to enjoy things that the child or teen used to enjoy, isolating, withdrawing from family and friends. Those could all be, you know, potential warning signs, changes in behavior, you know, abnormal, atypical, sometimes we'll call it, you know, sort of, you know, bizarre, unusual behavior. And what we want to do is try to get them connected with someone who can do more of a screening and an assessment. Now, I would say not that everyone has the expertise, but some options that, you know, families do have, caregivers have, would be one, you can go to a school, and schools are able to perform screenings. Actually, the Department of Education, while it has many challenges, actually has a pretty well-developed school-based behavioral health service. And school counselors can do at least a screening, a check-in. Going to your child's doctor, even a primary care provider, you can bring up these concerns. And they can also do sort of simple screenings for depression, anxiety. They may not be able to give a complete diagnosis or treatment, but they can help with referrals. Sometimes if it is more of a crisis, often, you know, a crisis team may be called out, or that, you know, child or adolescent may end up transported by police or ambulance to an emergency department. And obviously our emergency facilities, and primarily Queens Hospital, you know, have a full array of, you know, mental health and psychiatric services where they can get that assessment. But indeed, for the majority of this condition, there are these signs. And if we can sort of notice them, intervene, start getting help, start understanding
right, but
earlier.
Then what happens, though, if you actually need to have your child seen, or you mm-hmm. think something is going on? I mean, we don't have legions of child psychiatrists.
Correct. And that's really where, one, we have a huge need to develop workforce. And I'm not just talking, you know, physicians and psychiatrists. In fact, I would say we need more of everything else beyond that to sort of support. But indeed, more social workers, more therapists, more, you know, psychologists. So one thing is sort of, you know, developing that workforce. But a number of us, and again, I wouldn't minimize what you can do as a family member, a concerned friend, what a teacher can do, what a counselor can do, at least as an initial step to be there as you know, a resource, a source of help, a source of understanding, maybe directing that youth or child
but,
into
but maybe
services.
Just to a point, because as Jerry said earlier, there's a great deal of burnout when you get so deeply involved in that trying to, you know, manage your own life while you're also helping someone else manage his or hers, particularly if it's a child.
Absolutely. And that's where accessing, I think, some of those other community resources and supports, making sure you get help from some, and there are a number of, you know, organizations out there that, you know, do some of this. So that can be critical.
Well, we have a real problem in terms of Quest, and more people now qualify for Quest, but fewer and fewer and fewer doctors, particularly psychiatrists, child psychiatrists. I'm not sure any of them will. So, you know, I just got a call today from a legislator. I need to find a child psychiatrist for somebody on Quest. And I said, that's going to be a huge problem.
So, Bethann, I want to just jump in as a social worker. I have a bias. Interesting thing about children and adolescents is it isn't always possible to make a real firm diagnosis for young kids and young people because they're still growing and developing. Typically, you know, there's an age at which, you know, usually it's 20, 21 is when we know we can really make a very solid diagnosis.
Some would say not until 23 or 25 based on the brain research.
Which implies that in the absence of a very firm diagnosis, there isn't really often a lot of direction about what kind of medication you would be prescribing. And I would suggest medication isn't always necessary. Often what parents are struggling with and what schools are struggling with is characterological. It isn't biological. So for parents who are looking at a situation and seeing a child or an adolescent who's getting out of control, please, I guess what I would do is give them permission to see that as a safety issue. If your kid came in and they were bleeding and they needed stitches, you would put them in the car and take them to the emergency room. As parents, as adults, whatever it is about our current culture and society, a wonderful book, All the Joy, None of the Happiness. It's an interesting book that was just written about how we approach parenting. And particularly if there's a stigma that you feel is attached with that, get over it. It's a safety issue. Early intervention for a master's level therapist. You don't need a psychiatrist. You don't need to wait 4 months for a 45-minute appointment.
But I just want to make the point that we can't ignore the fact that serious mental illnesses strike between the ages of 15 and 24, three quarters of them. And
especially if they're undetected, completely undetected.
Right. And many of these kids were doing just fine. They were doing just fine. And then they were kind of struck down.
Like
you know, when they went to college, or like me, or my nephew at 18, and become psychotic. And you do need a psychiatrist. You do need medication. And it's probably a matter of experimenting with different kinds of medications, and definitely maybe residential. You might need residential, which we don't have here.
Another reason for reaching out to a therapist is that the identified patient when we're talking about children and adolescents isn't and shouldn't always just be the child and the adolescent. A therapist that's working with a family with a very troubled child needs to understand that the parents, as much as the child, are the identified patients, because those are the people who are most capable of having the greatest impact in the outcome.
All right. We're going to continue to talk about what it's like to be mentally ill in Hawaii, and we want to hear from you, too. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Call us sooner rather than later so that we can talk to you and have you join the discussion, too. Going now to Walter calling us. I'm sorry, Sean. Sean from Honolulu. Sorry, Sean. Didn't mean to go right over you. Thanks very much for your patience.
Yes, thank you, and thank you for doing this show. All of you have been very helpful, and I'm a parent of a grown man who is mentally ill and is currently at OCCC, and what I found out is that there are more mentally ill people at OCCC, the prison here, or the jail, than there are at the state hospital, yet because of what the state claims and as the headline said, there are shortages of guards on the weekend, which is the only time that Oahu residents can visit their loved ones. Most of the visits, the majority of the visits on Saturdays and Sundays, are canceled, so that the loved ones, the people that are best able to support their mentally ill relatives, cannot visit. And speaking to people, this is not a new problem. It's been going on for perhaps 20 years, and every once in a while there's a headline. And I've been working to try to change this, and I feel very frustrated. And I was wondering if anybody listening or any of the panel has any ideas how we can get this changed.
Thanks very much, Sean, for calling in, and you just stay with us. We've talked about what helps someone in prison, particularly when we've said, well, our prisoners, that we've sent them very far away, we want to really bring them home because they have family and other people to support them. But hearing what Sean has just said here makes it very difficult for those who are family members right here with someone right here who happens to be mentally ill.
That sounds like a problem that needs to be addressed at many levels. The level that we have control over is the level where we're at. And so as a family member, probably the most important thing we can do to avoid being in that situation again is to understand what are the things that I can do more of and less of as the loved one of this individual to prevent that person going back to jail. And so
Can I just say one thing?
Sure.
So what he's talking about is his son is in jail. And there are more mentally ill people there than there are in the hospital. So that's the first problem. The first problem is that our jails have become psychiatric institutions.
The new asylum.
Right, the new asylums. And so that's one whole issue, the criminalization of the mentally ill. So many of them are homeless, many of them are in jail, but they're not getting help. But I think the second thing he was talking about was his issue about the guards, at the jail, calling in sick, so there are no times for visit. And I think that is beginning to be addressed by the public safety division. But you know, that's a whole matter of how the state is going to deal with its employment at the jail. But I think it's the whole thing is symptomatic of the lack of a safety net and the lack of our whole society to figure out how we can prevent people from being arrested.
The two of you are talking about, you know, the greater issue, the more macro issue for for Sean trying to figure out how he can visit
how
his
he can
son.
Visit. Yeah,
is the real issue, and I wish we had some better answers for you. But that's a policy issue and one for public safety.
Yeah, public safety.
And
I
a
think
lot
is,
of attention is going hopefully in that direction.
Yeah. What it points to me is that, as Maria correctly points out, a lot of the most of the real assertive treatment for folks with mental illness is happening in prison, unfortunately, and also at state hospitals, also in psychiatric wards in hospitals across the state. And recently, excuse me, the state of Hawaii enjoyed a new law that most folks refer to as assisted community treatment. And the emphasis for the law is community. What the pattern has been for a lot of mentally ill folks is that they cycle in and out of jail, cycle in and out of the state hospital, cycle in and out of the emergency departments at many hospitals, cycle in and out of psych units, with no real resolution to the mental illness and to the symptoms. Assisted community treatment is the process that is currently hoping to address that, so that folks get the treatment and they get and there's a little bit more teeth, and that the support system and the safety net that we throw under some folks, those folks who would be appropriate for it, can begin to start working to avoid people getting their mental health treatment in prison.
And your point is, it may not be for everybody, but for those for whom it's, mm-hmm. it really mm-hmm. is important that it actually works.
That's correct.
And I would say we have the same problems with criminalization and incarceration,
yes.
in our adolescent population and juvenile justice. And I can say there's actually, in the same vein, a real effort to divert and decriminalize and get treatment for these kids before they become incarcerated, whether it's in our detention home, in our youth correctional facility. And we had another really landmark piece of legislation that was approved and went through this term that's really going to devote substantive resources and really bring stakeholders from across the state, mental health, family court, Office of Youth Services, which oversees the detention home and youth correctional facility, Department of Education, Department of Health, obviously. And we're really going to get together and try to meet the comprehensive needs. And really the key here is we want to provide treatment and resources and supports for these kids and their families. And again, I think we can be really successful. And the same idea, if we can get these kids out of the system before they ever get into it, we're doing a great service to them and to our community.
You know, you just mentioned a bill that just passed, which is so great. But I do want to mention one of the bad outcomes of this past legislature. And that was, for 7 years, the autism community has been trying to get insurance coverage for treatment for autism. And once again, it failed. And it failed around the issue of cost. Now, we happen to know that if you start treatment with kids on the autism spectrum early and you do it ongoing, you can prevent a lot of the problems that will arise without treatment. And you'll save millions of dollars. However, insurance companies are afraid of the cost of this treatment. The studies have shown that it only adds 1% to the cost of insurance. And yet, for the seventh year in a row, so this means families get bankrupted trying to get this treatment for their kids. So that was a good bill, and this is a bill that didn't pass.
And with everything, we know that it's never a perfect scenario, but that reminds me that we are going to have a show. We're only going to talk about autism a little later this spring.
Fantastic.
Now, we've got lots of callers on the line. We want to make sure you get through. So if you would like to join the conversation, do it now, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And I'm going to ask you guys to be brief, because all of a sudden the phones have just lit up like Christmas. Going now to Walter calling us from Salt Lake. Aloha, Walter. Welcome to Town Square.
Thank you for taking my call, and good evening.
You too.
Yes, hi. I was wondering, I heard that statistic you gave, over, was it 80% of your people you see at IHS or the homeless shelter has some kind of mental illness?
That would be my guess, yes.
So how is that situation? Say someone has schizophrenia, how are they going to get a job or get out of homelessness?
That's a great question. It would depend on a lot of things. It would depend on how long has that person had schizophrenia? How long have they been not participating in what you and I might consider mainstream society? Does that person have a criminal history? Does that person have an addiction? Have they developed a comorbid addiction using drugs and alcohol to manage their mental illness? And is that a secondary barrier that we'd have to work through with that person? Is that individual open to using medications as a way to clear up those symptoms that would make it possible for them to enter the workforce? There are a lot of questions that would need to be answered, but I can tell you that the most important thing we would do at IHS for a person who has that diagnosis would first be to get them into housing. If a person continues to land back on the street, it's useless to have a conversation about employment or education, because folks like that really just need to get housed. Housing equals health care, and housing equals mental health.
But isn't Hawaii in a housing crisis already? And don't people who are, let's say, normal, have a hard enough time trying to get housing?
Welcome to my world, buddy.
Well, I mean, that's just the whole point with all of this, and certainly everybody wishes that there were some easier, if not easy, but easier answers to be able to help people fix their lives. But you're looking at things that aren't happening in a vacuum. I mean, the confluence of many different issues, as Jerry, you just talked about a moment ago, with one person who might have schizophrenia, but where they are, what's happened, how many people are around them, all of that
there
plays
are housing,
into how
there are,
well it could be or not for that person.
There are housing subsidies. I didn't mean to be flip. There's definitely housing subsidies for folks who qualify with a verifiable disability, shelter plus care. It's not perfect. It's not something you get right away. But certainly with the help of a case manager and with a little bit of time and patience, there are housing subsidies for folks who have those verifiable disabilities.
And the other thing I'd like to add is that a particular diagnosis, whether it be schizophrenia or bipolar or a severe psychotic mental health disorder, does not necessarily mean that one cannot work, cannot be productive. Certainly treatment and control of any symptoms and again, any co-occurring if there's substance use that needs to be treated. But absolutely all these individuals can be functional, productive. It is a big picture sort of thing. So all their basics need to be met. And in many ways, again, when we were going back to these sort of social determinants, really social justice kind of issues, just access to the basic sorts of necessities.
Access to the basis and also what happens when they need care and having a place to put them.
Because if your basic needs aren't met, I would argue, how can you meet these higher level treatment needs? They're all predicated on your basic needs sort of being fulfilled and met first.
All right. I've got to meet some of the basic needs of our callers right now and let them in on this conversation before we have to say goodbye. Going to Jane calling us from Honolulu. Aloha, Jane. Thanks for your patience.
Hi. I have a question about post-traumatic stress syndrome. I was born to an 18-year-old mother who was pregnant but not married at the time, and my father was shipped off to England during the Second World War. I lived with the family, and I have no idea who it was, absolutely no idea who it was until I was 4 or 5. Finally met my father when I was 6, when he came back from England, and obviously my parents didn't care a whole lot about me. And one day when I was 13, my mother slapped me across the face, and suddenly it occurred to me, and I said, "You don't love me, do you?" She said, "No, I don't love you, and I haven't loved you since you were born." And then she went on with a long story about how she was pregnant and she had to leave me with somebody and really hadn't bonded with me, so forth and so on. But the treatment was always cruel. The words were always cruel. And by the time I was 16, I tried to commit suicide for the first time. By the time I was 21, I was divorced and had three young children. I've been to various therapists. I've had good deal of antidepressant drugs over the years. They work up to a certain point, and then after years, they seem to stop working. And there have been 2 or 3 things that have happened. One of them while I was working for the Sexual Assault Support Service in Hawaii, where I walked into a room, very small room, that had just been refurnished for these by us workers, and I completely and utterly went to pieces and ended up flying back to the mainland and committing myself to a mental institution. Later talked with a
Jane?
Psychiatrist, and she felt that it was probably something that happened during the time when I was with this family.
Which brings you back to your initial question about PTSD. I want to just go right around the table here after hearing some of her story. What would you say to Jane?
I think it's very likely that she has PTSD or symptoms of sequelae. And what I'm hearing is, again, that exposure to, you know, adverse events early on. And really the compelling thing I'm hearing is that, Jane, you didn't have relationships and attachments to loving, nurturing caregivers from an early age. And when we see that, we often see sort of a sequelae of outcomes, not unlike you've described. Now, on the positive, it can be something that can be treated, and a lot of it has to do with developing, you know, an understanding and really sort of an awareness and the point where you gain some control over it and stop blaming yourself for things that other people did that were very difficult.
Your story reminds me that one way of understanding PTSD or trauma is that trauma is not the event. We often think of the event or the exact thing, or we search for what is that one thing that's going to be for all of us something that would be traumatizing. And I don't think we'll have agreement about that. The truth is that trauma is our interpretation of an event. I also like that I heard the caller say that medication does help, and I would suggest a support group and surround yourself with people who understand how confounding that is.
So despite whatever happened in the past, you can make some choices to find some people to help her now?
100%.
Absolutely.
All right, Jane, thanks so much, and we wish you all the best. Going now to Mary, calling us from Kailua Kona. Aloha, Mary. Welcome to Town Square. Mary, you there? Okay, then we'll move on to Paige from Maui.
Hello. Thanks for bringing this topic up.
I'm sorry. Who is this? Is this Paige?
Yes.
Okay, just wanted to make sure. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I spent a reasonably long amount of time in the Hawaii prison system due to my own bad choices. But as a witness to all the anecdotal testimonies, there are hundreds of grown men that went through the youth correctional facility in Oahu there, and maybe they were bad people or slightly flawed kids when they went in, but after going through that experience, they were critically damaged. And this, the mistreatment of juveniles has to end. Mm-hmm. And it's horrible the way, I'm glad that they're getting some funding, but they've had a regime there in place at the boys' home for decades, and the abuse is legendary. So I just wanted to throw that in the ring.
Thank you, Paige. Thanks very much for the call. We're going to go off to Mary, who's now back, calling us from Kailua Kona. Aloha, Mary. No, I don't think so. I think there's a problem with the radio on.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay. Otherwise, we can't talk to you because we won't be able to hear you.
Right. Okay, can you hear me okay now?
We can, yes. You had a question?
Yes, I had a couple of questions. So I missed parts of the show.
Well, start with one because we're coming up to the top of the hour, so start with
one. All right, I'll just go directly to one question. I have a son, the age of 23, and you spoke of the ages of these things occurring between 18 and 25, which I'm noticing amongst a lot of my friends and their children this age. But one of the questions, the question I haven't heard discussed was the effects of video gaming at a young age and a real sort of heavy interest in it, and what effects that might have on some of these disorders we're discussing.
All right. Well, I mean, and that's a question, and Dan Ulrich, you must hear this a lot, where people are saying, well, surely this must be impacting how a child
absolutely
is perceiving the world.
It's a big issue and probably could merit a large discussion of its own. Certainly, I think there are indicators that it can be a contributing factor, and certainly the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, really recommends limits to video or video gaming exposure daily.
And this
but
is
then
screen-free
again,
week, by the way.
Yeah, absolutely. But then again, there are other studies that show that, wow, there aren't those kinds of links, and it's just really sort of just the more modern way of kids sort of, you know, expressing and interacting and doing many of those things that, you know, others would have done roaming out in, you know, in the woods or in the backyard or in the field. So I think a lot more research really, you know, needs to be done before we can really make definitive
determinations. The bottom line that you're saying is that there is no definitive causality that goes right back to video games.
Correct. That at this point.
Although a lot of people would say doesn't help.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We're coming up to last couple minutes of the show, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit because we spent a lot of time talking about kids and talking about what can happen, and a lot of parents, I'm sure, have been listening to this and others who have been saying that, you know, the what do you do part of this is so, in some ways, nebulous because you don't know exactly where to go, how to go. There are families that can sit down and talk to you in a very quiet, confidential setting. I know you talked about a little bit what NAMI offers, Jerry. But in general, for a parent who is feeling hopeless and powerless and is watching a child who is either an adolescent or a young adult or maybe even somebody who's in their 30s and 40s and feeling that somehow they didn't parent correctly or they must have done something wrong or what can they do now to make amends or how do I fix this kid? That's an ongoing cycle, and then might turn into something that somebody might say, well, that could be mental illness too if it goes too long and too hard. What do you say when you're talking to parents and to concerned friends, just in general, about this beyond what we've already told them?
Well, Maya? You know, what I always ask them is, what kind of insurance do you have? I hate to be really crass, but if you have a private insurance, then you can help your child or your loved one get care and treatment, you know, get psychiatric care, get mental health counseling, social work counseling. If you qualify for Quest and the person has a severe mental illness, then you can get services. You can get services. There are a lot of good programs in place. So it's terrible, but that's the first thing I ask. What kind of insurance do you have?
That feels incredibly cut and dried in some ways.
Yeah.
And if somebody doesn't have insurance?
It's the very first question we ask when folks come into the homeless shelter, because it affects everything.
Right.
It's either a pathway or it's a complete barrier.
Everything. That's exactly correct.
Yeah. And I would say it's very much the same for kids. And again, it's a core part of sort of our eligibility determination. You know, when we look at kids, I think we're all hopeful that as a state and as a nation, we can get beyond this. And not that the political sorts of thoughts around, you know, ACA, but at least the theory is that everyone should have insurance and coverage and be able to access coverage regardless of their means or, you know, ability to pay. And that's, I think we would all agree, a place that we want to get to.
Well, Mario, when we talked early in the week, you said, you know, Hawaii is not, you know, any worse than a lot of states are. And in fact, in many ways, it's no better.
Right, right. I think the entire country is suffering from the same problem of the criminalization of people with mental illness, of a lack of a safety net, of this inhumane treatment where people with mental illness become homeless, and the lack of psychiatrists, child psychiatrists, psychologists. You know, I think that's everywhere, and I think some communities are coming to grips with it better than other communities, and Hawaii is working on it, but, you know, there are a lot of barriers. It's tough.
Jerry.
You know, Beth Ann, we're talking about this tonight, and the most important thing that comes from a conversation in this context is to break the isolation and to talk about it. So I want to remind your listeners to not be isolated. If you're dealing with a family member or a child where mental illness is really taking a toll on your family, please reach out. And I want to remind your listeners that there's an organization called Mental Health America that has resources at their fingertips to point you in the right direction and explain things like what Mario was just describing, and also NAMI. If you call the NAMI number, it's 591-1297, which stands for the National Alliance for Mental Illness. You will receive a warm handoff to a facilitator that runs any one of our support groups or family-to-family classes in an area near you. We have about 9 groups and classes happening across the state each week.
Bottom line, don't feel alone and reach out.
100%.
And it's nothing to be ashamed about. It's nobody's fault.
And that's the
fault.
Other thing, is taking the stigma off it. And
yes.
The more people who reach out and talk to each other, the less we're going to be seeing a stigma attached to
this. It's not your fault.
Absolutely. And real quick, a quick and easy resource for kids and families. HelpYourKeiki.org can answer, be a one-stop shop for a lot of answers for local resources.
I'll tell you what, I'm
going to
put all of this stuff on the Hawaii Conversation Facebook page as soon as we get off the air, and you'll be able to get it just in case that went by you a little too quickly. I want to thank all of you for being here tonight. Maria Grams from Mental Health America of Hawaii and Jerry Coffey of IHS and NAMI. And thanks very much to Dan Ulrich, who is the State Department of Health, Child and Adolescent Mental Health Division Director. And for you being here, too. We'll talk more about this, and I will see you tomorrow morning right here for The Conversation. Have a good evening.